It's the True Faith Podcast, and this is Mark Corby, your host, and we're going to be doing another As It Was When It Was special. Absolutely delighted to be joined by an old friend of mine. It's a bit of a Cilla Black surprise moment, this, because I haven't seen this chap for a good number of years, possibly 20 plus. I'm delighted to be joined by David Jameson, who I first got to know through a fanzine back in the early 90s. Dave was the editor of a fantastic fanzine called Half Magpie, Half Biscuit, and then it was tweaked a little bit to be known as Half Mag, Half Biscuit between 1992 and 1995. Dave, how are you doing, mate? It's good to see you again.
It's great to see you, Mark. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. Looks as if we maybe come to the end of this baffling 3-month period under lockdown. Football's back, so and we're winning games for a change, so things are on the up, shall we say. Going back to the fanzine, if you don't mind me quickly mentioning, Dave, I mean, I'm very fond of, and I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking to you now, mate, but I'm very fond of that period regardless, because 1992 and 1995, as you know, absolutely fantastic journey with Kevin Keegan coming back. It's personally my most enjoyable period following Newcastle. I was you could say coming of age as a teenager into leaving me comprehensive school, and I don't know whether you knew this, mate, but you actually gave me my first ever published article for the fanzine. The article was called "Where Were You When We Were Shit?" And it was a reaction from me to Manchester City supporters, ironically, singing that song at St. James's Park on New Year's Day in 1994. And I got a bit upset about that. But then I put it into perspective. I thought, actually, where were these supporters when we were shit? So it was sort of like a contradictory article with me back up saying, how dare Man City say this? But then I was questioning our own support. And you published it, mate. So thanks to you, I got on a long journey of getting to writing and podcasting the like, mate. So a little show.
You were an author. we made you into an author. It's hardly surprising, really, that we published it, because we were desperate for anything. We'd publish anything in those days.
No, I think you're being hard on yourself. If I remember rightly, Dave, that the fanzine was it was more mates in a pub type. It was realistic, yeah. You know. There was some fantastic writing in it. One that sprung to my mind, I haven't looked at it for years, but it was the write up that you did when we sold Andy Cole, and I'm getting actual goosebumps, because you concluded the whole piece, and obviously everyone was upset and gutted to lose Andy Cole, but you concluded it, and I'll never forget these words: without wanting to write an epitaph, Andy Cole will never be forgotten. You concluded with that, and I just thought, wow, and that stuck with me ever since, mate. And but interestingly, we've just signed Keith Gillespie to the podcast. The first one got released this morning, and you interviewed him at that time as well, didn't you, mate? You ended up finding him in his hotel, having a good bit crack with him, didn't you?
We did. God, we did. Through a mutual friend who lived in the Manchester area, we got in touch. Through that mutual friend and set it up. If not the day after, 2 days after he signed. So it was, around that time when, the controversial transfer exchange had happened, and everybody, as you say, everybody was still up a height. And we couldn't believe our luck when we got the notification that, you can go and go to the Gosforth Park Hotel tomorrow night and Keith will come down and see you. And it was like, whoa. I'm convinced to this day we didn't make the most of it. It was like a mates in the pub kind of interview. We didn't know how to interview people properly, to get information out of them, to get stories out of them. But it was a lot of fun, as it was a lot of fun for us doing the magazine from start to finish. That in particular is a standout moment, sitting down with Keith. And we took him to celebrate afterwards. We took him down onto the boat for a few sherbets afterwards, which he enjoyed as well. So I can't remember what it was like in terms of the publicity. Obviously, it was all over the Chronicle, but obviously without social media, I think the ability for people to recognise him in the town was probably a slow starter. So we took him on the boat, and nobody recognised him until later. You know, until, you know, after about half an hour, a couple of lads sort of would tentatively, "Is that Keith Gillespie?" You know, and we sort of felt like it's you know, we were looking after him for the night. You know,
brilliant. Well, he was only 19 at the time, and you were roughly that age as well, Dave, weren't you, back then?
1995. Well, I was. No, I'll have been 22
right
around then. Yeah. So my 20th birthday was actually that Grimsby away when we clinched promotion. So that, I'll never forget that.
Brilliant.
For more reasons than the obvious. So yeah.
It's always good to look back, and I suppose that's the key to these sort of podcasts, going back in time. But before we go back to the season that you've wanted to discuss, which we've wanted to do for a long time, but it's getting the right person for it. Current affairs, Dave. You told me before we come on here that you haven't been going for a few years now, and it's no surprise that you mentioned Mike Ashley in that part of the conversation. Just tell the listeners, mate, what was the final, you know, nail in the coffin, as it was, for you to stop going?
Well, it was strange. It was sort of during the Pardew. The infamous Pardew sort of period, then seemingly never ending, and I'd kind of I think like a lot of people, everybody's got the breaking point, and you know, I wasn't old enough to see the 78 disaster, but I was old enough to see the, you know, the 88 one, and all of the subsequent relegations that we've enjoyed since, and yeah, it got to the point where I was coming home thinking, what am I doing? I've got better things to do with my time and cash, you know. And we were skirting, you know, flirting relegation, and he wouldn't. It just, there was this reluctance to almost prove himself wrong by saying to Pardew, look, it's not working out. You better go. And he'll pat himself on the back, actually, you know, by waiting out, and, you know, we got the compensation of Crystal Palace in the end. Not the way to do it, because we suffered during that time. And I just thought, you know what, I love the club from top to bottom, but I've had enough of this. And it really, something snapped in me. And it's going to take a lot for me to go back, I think. Even if the takeover goes through, and, you know, the tickets should first and foremost go to the people who've been going all the way through. I'm a bit mixed about calling people who wouldn't give up their season ticket part of the problem, because I understand the struggle that they will have had. You know, anybody who's quit the season ticket, it's a really difficult decision to make, because you start to get upset about it when you think of it. You start to think of all the good times, you know, with your mates, with your family, with your dad or whatever, you know, your first game, you know, some of the memorable games, memorable players that you've seen, you know, and you start to get upset about it. You think, am I really letting this guy throw all this away from me? But it just, I was overwhelmed with that feeling that, yeah, this is just, this guy's sucking the place dry, and I don't want to contribute 600, 700 quid a year to help him.
That's understandable. You're not the only one. We've had numerous stories. I personally, my first cutting point was when we appointed Sam Allardyce. I packed in my season ticket. I thought, I just do not want to watch Sam Allardyce manage Newcastle side. And we won the first game of the season. We beat Bolton away 3-1. Fantastic all-out attacking football. I ran the club back. Oh, I want my seat back. You know. And so that was
yeah,
my
yeah.
That was my first get out of jail card. I didn't take it. But as you say, here we are. What, it's 13 years later, and I'm still going. But I think it's more out of a social aspect, Dave. It's more out of making sure that, you know yourself, as you get older, your time with your friends is quite unique now. It's quite rare. Christ, it's took us 20 odd years to catch up, you know, so that goes to show. But
right, yeah.
But the point being, the actual football side of it isn't the enjoyable side. And
No, absolutely.
I think you've made some very good points there. Will the takeover make people rush back? I think we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? Maybe people have got used to not going, and as you said before, we're finding different things to do with your time. But we'll save that for another podcast, Dave. The reason we've got you on another topic. Yeah, definitely, mate. the main reason we've got you on, mate, is because, I mean, you know, without holding back, 1983-84, absolutely fantastic season. I was too young to attend. I didn't start going properly until early 1988, but I'd been a fan for a number of years. So I missed it. Yeah. I missed out on that. I missed out on the impact of Keegan, the attendance boom, things like that, which obviously I want you to educate me more on, and hence we're getting you on. Now, tell us how it all started, Dave, because obviously, you know, always ask this, all interested to know your first game Newcastle. And obviously at the time, a lot of people around this era always talk about how they've either got a choice to support the most successful team in the country, which a lot of people do these days with Man City and so on. Do they support Newcastle United, or do they support Sunderland, mate? So what choices did you have back then?
Well, I had a strange one. My memory is not what it was, but certainly for back then. But I'm pretty sure my first game was actually probably a Darlington game, because that's that's where I was born. That's where my sort of family came from, and moved up to Whitley Bay when I was six. So that would have been about 79, kind of period. And I think moving up to Whitley Bay, I think it was we were that bit closer to kind of the bigger northeast sides. My dad was kind of like, "How we'll go," and he took us to Roker Park. And the reason for it was simple. They were in Division One, Newcastle weren't. And he figured, well, let's go and, you know, see, not necessarily Sunderland, but see some other great players that are kicking around the First Division. So he took us to a handful of games. And long story short, I didn't enjoy it because I think I was a bit too young. I was probably, it was probably the 1980 season. I was about seven. I didn't enjoy the journey through the tunnel, and the football was poor. I mean, I was no aficionado, but the football was poor. They were getting beat every time, it seemed, and I just sort of said to my dad, "Look, I don't like this," and he said, "Well, I'll take you," and I think he thought I was a bit young as well, so he took us up to Newcastle the year after, and the first game was in the 81-82 season, actually, at home to Oldham Athletic, which was just the complete polar opposite experience for me. And I don't know why.
Yeah.
And I've tried to analyse why. Because at the end of the day, the quality of football will have arguably been poorer.
In the game but someone would have been top flight then, wouldn't they? And we were second division.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was seeing them play Spurs with, you know, with Mickey Hazard, Steve Archibald, you know, Ray Clements, Hoddle, and West Ham, you know, Frank Lampard's dad.
Yeah.
And Billy Bonds, you know, and people like that, and Trevor Brooking, and saw them play Southampton, which was the key game, really, because Keegan was playing for Southampton. And I was just transfixed when he came over to the touchline with the ball, and you know where I was just transfixed. I was like, "My God, there's Kevin Keegan," and he was my football hero before any of this. I think he was just the obvious football hero for any kid in the 70s or English kid. And so I did get something out of it. You know, seeing some great players in the Southampton side. Southampton seemed to have half the England side at the time.
Right, yes.
I don't think Shilton had signed, but they had like Dave Watson and Mick Shannon and Keegan. And so, you know, I saw some great players. Sunderland didn't fare very well out of it. And I think they survived that season and went down the year after, didn't they? But I suppose it... In one sense, it kind of made me see, you know, both sides a little bit. And, you know, for these diehard Sunderland fans, we all know them, went to school with them, work with them. They're all good lads, you know, mostly. And there's nothing, you know, there was nothing wrong with you know, with going to the match, you know, down at Sunderland. It just, as a 7 year old, it wasn't for me, and I'm quite pleased that that was the case, because we wouldn't be having this chat on the phone.
That's certainly true, mate. And so you mentioned the Oldham game, you won 2-0. Memorable. I remember a few years ago, I think you did a bit of a Twitter sort of search for that goal, and I had it, but I hadn't put it on YouTube. And I remember sending you the little clip of the goal. Was it Brownlee, an individual goal for a fullback, and he just back of the net?
He levered it. Yeah. Well, David Mills got the first one. Yeah. He took it around the keeper, and I remember it. I remember it more clearly than some of this 83-84 season.
Yeah.
But because there was a number of things, but the way he was on the edge of the box, and he, you know, bear in mind it was March, pitches what weren't what they are now, so the, you know, the pitch was bare down the middle, and I remember him skipping past the goalkeeper and just slotting it in. I thought, hey, that's great, that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then Brownlee, I think he seemed to rattle one in from 25 yards to seal the point. But I was hooked. But the most, and my dad will remember this, so the most trivial reason I was hooked wasn't anything to do with going to the match. You know, the sight of the lush green pitch wasn't particularly lush green in back in March of that year. But it was, believe it or not, it was the scoreboard. Because as a wide-eyed sort of 8-year-old, as I would have been at the time, the goals went in, and these three dancing men appeared on the scoreboard, and I was absolutely mesmerised. And that, I'm not ashamed to say, was what hooked me. I thought, hey, this is all brilliant. You know, Newcastle are a great side. They've won 2-0. They're a great side. You know, it's near at home. You know, I don't mind the travel into town. And you know, they've got that scoreboard, so it was like, Dad, can we go back? And I think we went to a handful more games that season, but I think you know, and again, unashamedly, we picked up season tickets the following season.
You've had an introduction. It's always good to go to your first game and win. My first game, we won 5-0. We beat Swindon in the cup, and Paul Gascoigne was unbelievable then. So what an introduction. It's been downhill ever since, Dave, to be honest. But yeah, we beat Oldham 2-0, second division football. You mentioned Kevin Keegan, and obviously, you know, can you remember, because obviously it was towards the back end of pre-season, and it shocked the football world, didn't it, really, when he signed. I think it was a week or so before the start. So did you get your season tickets on the back of that signing?
Definitely. I mean, I couldn't, there's no way I could say otherwise. I'd be lying if I did. It was, I think we would have gone, you know, we would have probably just gone to the odd game. But yeah, that without a doubt, that sealed it. And because I think, you know, my dad's very fruity, still with, I shouldn't say was, he's still with us, but he's, back then he was very frugal, and it needed to take something like Keegan signing for him to get his checkbook out, for sure.
You know, because I'm a sucker for trying to defend Newcastle United supporters, I suppose it's whatever suits the narrative, you know. But when I hear people say, well, Newcastle's attendances were shocking before Kevin Keegan came as a footballer, and they were shocking before he came as a football manager, it's a myth, because, you know, granted, there was only 18,500 there when you went to your first game. But I've just quickly browsed at the fixtures and the attendances. For whatever reason, I can only speculate, because I haven't got the table in front of me, that Chelsea and Leicester were going for promotion, or it was just a big draw back then. Because we got nearly 27,000 against Chelsea a week after that game against Oldham, you mentioned. And we also got nearly 26,000 against Leicester. So, you know, granted, the last game of the season, in a game which counted for nothing, we got nearly less than 10,000 against Wrexham. But I just hate it when people say, you know, you had 10,000 in your last home game before Keegan arrived. Because it's an isolated fixture, it's an isolated stat, you know. So
it is, and I think something, again, in the podcast you did with Mick about the 86-87 season, something that you guys touched on there was that. There's no way that those attendances are accurate.
Yeah.
from those days.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I can take looking at some of the attendances from that era. I can take the odd 1,000 or 2,000, even 3,000 or 4,000 discrepancy, because a lot of it depended on how they configured the leaders end for the away fans. But and sometimes they left the huge centre section empty, which probably cost them about, you know, maybe 3,500 places. But yeah, it's all relative. And yeah, the attendances were poor in you know, 80 through to 82, but they were everywhere. Even Arsenal and Man United weren't filling the grounds back then, because football wasn't the product it is now. You know, football was, I look back and I'm convinced that if Keegan hadn't come, Newcastle would have been in serious trouble in the 80s as an organisation.
So what about the social aspect, Dave? You mentioned there, you know, football wasn't a product, and unfortunately, I think you may agree with this. Football has a tendency to probably eat itself as time elapses. But back then, 1982, Newcastle signed Kevin Keegan, worldwide superstar in football of the year. I think he got twice, laden with winners' medals. Shocked the footballing world, second division football. But what about the social aspect? Would I be right in thinking that, you know, your father and other people had to go to the football to get away from a mundane existence, shall we say, without sounding too melodramatic there? You know, was the life away from football, you know, was it depressing, you know, the social aspect? You tell me, mate.
No, I think it's an interesting point. No, I mean, in our situation, our circumstances, I would say no. I mean, I feel, when I've been looking back at all of this stuff, I feel incredibly proud to have, not something that I've had a huge amount of control over, but proud to have been able to go to those matches at that time, because what an amazing era. But also incredibly lucky, you know, because not everybody, you know, would have the wherewithal, or, you know, have a dad who could just buy a pair of season tickets, you know. And so I feel incredibly lucky that we were able to go around that time. But no, I mean, not, we had a good life. You know, my dad had a good job. I wouldn't have said it was to escape that. I think it was more just the thing that's what lads and dads did. And it was, you know, I think my dad was always hoping that I would be interested in football. I was always kicking a ball around with him in the garden, and I think he probably thought, well, you know, he liked going to the match. That's good. And I think, let's face it, my dad was probably as keen as I was back then, because Kevin Keegan had signed, and I think a lot of people were the same. And you know, the attendances, I think. You go back and it's sort of, I don't know, 9,000 or 10,000 against Wrexham or QPR or whatever. And then, but there was like, the attendances were like that everywhere, because I think in the world, in the country, things weren't going exactly to plan around that time. You know, we would all get home, you know, sit on a Sunday tea time and watch Bullseye and, you know, enjoy the great football and things. But you know, in society, things weren't going right. You know, Thatcher had just been re-elected, you know, and the racism was a huge problem in the country. But you know, it found its way in the football. The miners' strike led to particularly for fans of clubs in mining strongholds, so the northeast, you know, Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire and Wales, and it all fed into you know, the big disease that is called a football disease, but for me it was always a social disease of crowd trouble and hooliganism, because people, you know, you'd have people who would just be happy to go down for a battle. And I've never understood that, probably because I've never been a hard man. I've never wanted to get into fights, really, because I don't have a fair idea how they would turn out. So I've never really wanted to get involved in that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's sickening, and it led to the fences. and ultimately years later contributes to Hillsborough. So there were a lot of problems, you're right to point that out, around that time, that kind of led to a lot of the difficulties. But in terms of us going, it was very much a lads and dads thing. Yeah.
Well, before we get into the season, we're kind of overlooking his debut. You know, as we mentioned there, 35, nearly 36,000. Where was your season ticket, Dave? And what are your memories, if you've got any, because it was such a long time ago, of the day?
Boiling hot day. I remember we drove up in the car. I can't remember where we parked, but it would have been either in one of those car parks behind the Gallagher.
Right.
Or even over in Manners, because the business park in Manners hadn't been built then, and the old Manners station was still there. So I think there was a lot of... there was a bit of waste ground around there and a couple of car parks, and we might have walked over the footbridge. But we were in the West Stand. I remember Bobby Robson was there, I think, wasn't he? And I remember people were kind of booing him because I think he'd just knocked Keegan out of his squad, hadn't he, at that time?
That's right, yeah.
But, I just remember it being, you know, we were inside this big metal container, the old West Stand. Boiling hot it was, and... it was just, it was a whirlwind of a day, as everybody knows, and there's that footage out there of his debut goal, which in the Gallagher just absolutely erupted. It was like an explosion of people, and it just absolutely fantastic just to look back on. But and I remember the guy running on the pitch, with the luminous sock.
Yes.
It's strange what sticks in the mind.
Well, but it's funny because, again, just swatting up a little bit on this, you know, obviously, you know, I've got my YouTube channel with the footage, and I thought, I'm going to watch Keegan's debut again. And the things I remember, obviously, I've got the footage, that's all I can go by. We're discussing a period of time where footage wasn't readily available, so you're going from memory a lot of what we're going to be discussing. But one thing I did... remember from that footage was you mentioned Bobby Robson again. We're talking about myths in football. There's a saying that Newcastle supporters spat at Bobby Robson and the roundly booed him. You might have got booed. One person may have spat at him, but the TV camera shows the supporters applauding him. You know, in Roger Thames, commentator chief of the 80s and 90s. He says, you know, Bobby Robson's here and he's getting roundly applauded from Newcastle supporters. You know, a little bit of respect there. Mm. So I think that the point I'm trying to make is you know, and you'll agree, I'm sure, is don't believe everything you read, because there's always two sides to the story. But brilliant memories, Dave. Absolutely. I mean, we kicked on quite slowly that season, to be perfectly honest with you. One thing I did look at is obviously Chris Waddle was a raw talent back then, and he was quickly dropped not long after Keegan had come in. And I don't know whether you're aware of this, but apparently Chris Waddle went with his mates to Oldham away in the back of a transit, and was pissed out of his head. And rumour has it that Kevin Carr was back in the nets, and he went to get the ball from the crowd, and he spotted Chris Waddle, and he went, "What the hell are you doing?" And then Chris Waddle was standing on the terraces, pissed out of his head with his mates singing Newcastle songs. And I just think it just goes to show how different football was then, you know.
Well, this is exactly it. I mean, it wasn't as popular as it was then. You know, I mean, it's the right thing now. The families go, women and children go. More than they did, but certainly back then it wasn't the place for women and children, particularly away games. And that contributed to poor attendances as well, by the way. But I mean, 82-83 was full of expectation and just unfortunately just didn't quite get there. And I think because Keegan suffered that injury. I always remember this Darren Wood, but I always remember thinking, oh God, I wonder how terrible Darren Wood must be feeling now. But it was in a testimonial game, wasn't it, with Middlesbrough, but he only missed five games, and I just think that we were We weren't sort of firing on all cylinders like we were the year after.
Well, you mentioned them 5 games, though, Dave. When you look at the bigger picture, we had a great run at the end of the season, and we only fell short of automatic promotion, because this is obviously before the playoffs were introduced. We only fell short by 3 points. In them games that Keegan missed, we only won one. So it just goes to show the impact. Even though, as you rightly say, we didn't get off to a fantastic start. You know, there's some standout games. Rotherham away 5-1 on the telly. On Match of the Day, at least. But as we say, Arthur Cox was starting to build the jigsaw, as it was. He bought back Terry McDermott. He signed Davey McCreary from Man United. John Anderson had arrived as well. Martin Thomas was replacing Steve Hardwick.
I think you're seeing the nucleus of 83, 84 coming in there. I can't decide whether, I know that Arthur Cox knew a player, because he knew Peter Beardsley and he knew he wanted him. I remember I was looking through some of the old programs, and there was some program notes by Arthur Cox, actually, which followed. I think we must have played a junior game against Leeds, and he in his notes he singled out a couple of the young players from Leeds. And bear in mind, this was like 1980, early 83, but the two players were Dennis Irwin and Scott Sellers. the guy knew a player. I think that was definitely the nucleus of the promotion side coming through, certainly with Davey Mack and John Anderson were influential for sure.
Well, fast forward into the following season. I suppose what are your memories, if any, of Cox's decision to sell Imre Vardy? Because again, there's two sides to every story. You know, he was top scorer in the 82-83 season. I've read and heard rumours that Keegan and Vardy had a bit of a fallout, so Keegan basically said to Arthur Cox, you need to get rid of him. I've seen a talking with Keegan, and he point blankly didn't say a bad word about Vardy. He actually praised him to the hilt. But selling Vardy, and he didn't have a replacement lined up straight away. I mean, have you got much memories of that? Or what's your thoughts on that actual decision?
I didn't know Vardy that well, because I've not seen a lot of him. I've still not seen a lot of him, because as you know, much of your frustration, the lack of footage around that time is a problem. If you want to go back and look something up. But still, I didn't know an awful lot about him. I knew he was, our best hope for getting goals. What was funny about around those times was that I don't know whether it was just because I was focused on other things or a bit too young to pay attention, but lots of these things passed me by at the time. So players coming and going would often pass me by. It'd get to the next season and be like, "Wow, where's so and so? Oh, we sold him. Oh, did we?"
Right.
Because these days with social media and you've got all this information comes delivered to you on your phone wherever you are, and it's a cliche to say it, but you had none of that then, so you would have to go and seek out this news. And as a 10-year-old, I would just probably wouldn't. So I didn't really know an awful lot about it. Looking as I did in the subsequent years, sort of 84, 85, as I got a bit more savvy about things, I looked back on it and felt it was a curious decision. Like you say, not least because we didn't have a replacement lined up. Although he was obviously David Mills came back in the other direction as part of that deal, didn't he? So we did get to, we got David Mills that sort of a attacking midfield striker player who slotted in, and he's one of my sort of players of note for that promotion season, actually, which we can come on to. But he slotted in and did well wherever he had to.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, we didn't. I think I suppose what was to come I suppose, in regards to who did end up being his replacement. You mentioned Peter Beardsley. But at that point, we were very inconsistent, weren't we? Again, we were sitting in seventh spot at the time. I think we won as many as we lost. We drew a couple. Nothing of real great note because, again, as you mentioned, the footage isn't out there to sort of recap on the goals unless you were there. Attendances were still pretty consistent, still well over 20,000. But Beardsley come in, made his debut away to Barnsley. We got a 1-1 draw. And then he made his first start at home to Portsmouth. And, you know, is it a coincidence that Beardsley comes in and we're just picking up form straight away? We won six off the bounce.
I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. I think Peter Beardsley, the number of players, and I'll say it now before I forget, but the number of players for me that season who stood out, but obviously for lots of different reasons. And the obvious one, number one, is that season would not have happened without Kevin Keegan. But going back to your question, even with Keegan, I think Peter Beardsley was what made the difference. You know, he was the replacement for Verratti. You know, so we had lost in the first sort of few weeks, we had lost that threat. But Beardsley coming in, he came in with little baggage. He had very little sort of reputation. I don't mean that in a bad way necessarily, but nobody really sort of knew an awful lot about him, except he was a local lad. So they're like, all right, well. So that gave him a tick in the box for people before we started, you know, in the old cliche, you know, team full of Geordies. And he came in and he was a breath of fresh air. I remember that much. He wasn't afraid to pick up the ball and keep it and carry it and move around with it and look for people rather than it being this hot potato that everybody wanted to get rid of. And so I think it's I don't think it is a surprise because I know it was the game before. I'm looking at the fixtures, where the Crystal Palace home game was the start of that that run. I think we went on a 6-game winning streak in October. In fact, a 100% record in October. And I don't think it's any coincidence that was when Beardsley came in.
Well, I mean, the first time I have a look at him, granted it was on for me, it was the TV footage, but I always remember the season review of 83-84 season. This was the Football League, the Canon League as it was then. They released an official video, so it showed you Liverpool romping to the title, the promotion race and all the other divisions. And at the time, early 90s when I got a hold of a copy, and one of my memories is that they showed the highlights of the game against Charlton, 2-1. It's now on YouTube, of course. But one of the greatest memories of that is, you know, we're playing Charlton at home, who, let's be honest, they're not really a household name. Great turnout. We're getting beat 1-0. But Keegan, two quick goals. And what I love about the footage, and I encourage anyone to have a look at it, is when it zooms in on the supporters on the terraces, it's absolutely pissing it down with rain. But you can see the steam rising from all the supporters. And there's loads of little anecdotes about that game, you know, of supporters saying, well, I was there, I left the ground and my programme was just stuck to my pants in my back pocket, soaking through. Yeah. And that's always a little fond memory. Granted, I wasn't at the games, but a fond memory to look back. But I suppose a key game, because early on this season, we knew who the promotion challengers were going to be. And Manchester City were definitely going to be one of those. But for us to, you know, host them at home, and you mentioned Peter Beardsley so soon into his Newcastle career. I mean, what's your memories of any of that particular performance? Or, you know, do you think that might have been the catalyst for what was going to happen?
I think it was, I mean, looking back, you know, you can take your pick in games of games around that time that sort of, you know, served to set out our stall as promotion candidates, or if not title challengers, actually.
Yeah.
That season, and the Man City one was definitely one of them. But I'm going to disappoint you here, Mark. I didn't go.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then this was another sort of fervent fear of mine around that time as a Because what a lot of my friends, myself included, and a lot of my friends would have a tendency to do for the birthdays is have a football party. So you sort of hire Concordia or some similar place, you know, and get 10 lads and have a game of five-a-side and then, you know, a bit party food afterwards. And it was great, you know. But one guy arranged his for October the 29th, mm-hmm. 1983.
Yeah.
Well, I say arranged it. That was his birthday. I don't think he could help it.
So how did you find out the result? Back then,
I think one of the parents at the party came up. Exactly, one of the parents or my dad sort of came over and told me as the party was wrapping up. And sort of said, and I sort of smiled and went, oh, you know, and sort of thought, great, you know, good result. And I thought, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know whether.
But that was kind of the thing at the time, though. It was like, for me, it felt like whenever there was, I mean, it sounds horrible because an invitation to a party, you know, you should be like, oh, great, thanks, you know. But whenever an invitation to a party came around, I was straight onto the fixture list. I think, please don't clash, because I didn't obviously want to miss any matches, but I can't remember why. I think he was a good mate at school, and I didn't want to let him down, and I thought it was a tough choice, you know. But it was a kind of choice you had at that age.
Yeah, and let's be honest. If you were a few years older, you probably would have went to the match. Let's be honest, because you get to a point where you. Without sounding a bit of an arsehole here, you start picking and choosing events, don't you? But I don't know whether this top trumps this your story there, Dave, because in 1990, I don't know if you remember, well, you will remember, when we beat Leicester 5-4, we're 4-2 down, and we come back to beat them 5-4. And I was on a family holiday. I use the word holiday loosely, mind, but we went up to Jedburgh at the time, and we spent a week up there, and we knew we were going to miss the game. But we won a bit of a bad run of form at the time. We'd stepped well off the promotion races, but we'd just signed Roy Aiken. And I was still, you know, I still wanted to go to the games, but, you know, lo and behold, missed the game, 5-4. Couldn't believe it when the old grandstand vidi printer was telling you the goals were coming in. And I went to school on the Monday, and I don't know why to this day, but I told a complete lie. I told all my mates who I normally went with, oh, yeah, I was there. They're like, well, why don't you pick up your phone and why don't you come with us? Obviously, landlines, then no mobiles. I just made my own way. They're looking at us and going, why would you have went the match on your own? And you were just beetroot red, being found out. So yeah, mate, I feel your pain with that when you miss such a memorable occasion. But back to 1983, 84, obviously, as you mentioned, fantastic run of form. And then the big test, though, you know, then we went to Chelsea and Sheffield Wednesday, conceded 8 goals in the two games and conceded 2. So, you know, you could say was that a massive kick in the face. Two promotion rivals there, hammering were on their turf.
Well, it was, and on the back of what was actually a 9-game unbeaten run as well.
Yeah.
So we you know, we'd got some good points in the bag there. But yeah, that was. I think that was the difference between promotion and promotion and the title. Ultimately, I think those two games there, I think, highlight that Chelsea and Sheffield Wednesday were at least as good as us that year. So it was a very strong top three or four. Man City were quite a way off the pace actually by the end. They were about 10 points off, weren't they? In fourth place, but. And I always remember that thinking, yeah, we've earned our promotion. You know, it's not like we've scraped up. We're bloody 10 points clear here. And actually, you know, with some of the performances that season, we deserve to go up. But then it was a pleasure, you know, to watch sides like Chelsea and Sheffield Wednesday as well that year, because they were really exciting, tough, you know, entertaining games and you know, sort of you on a knife edge as well, and especially with what it, you know, what it led to, you know, what was at stake really from those games, and that, quite fitting that definitely the top three was the best three sides of that season, but to ship 8 goals was yeah, well, and I think that probably told Arthur Cox, it probably just underlined something for Arthur Cox, because it wasn't long after that he ran out and brought Glenn Roeder from QPR, wasn't it?
It was, and obviously, I failed to mention earlier, we had signed two new fullbacks, Malcolm Brown and John Ryan. Malcolm Brown,
the unluckiest guy.
Yeah.
He did his Achilles in training just after he signed and missed the whole season. But he was back the year after, I recall he was playing the year after. And I think, unfortunately, John Ryan, I think he was a bit of a name at Oldham, wasn't he? But he was, I don't think he was the answer as a fullback. As it was, if you ask me my, you know, if you say Newcastle United fullback to me, I'll always say John Anderson.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
You know,
a fullback. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's just
as if I was just, if you were to say Newcastle, you know, centre mid number four, Davy Mack.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of those seasons that I could reel off to you, you know, the team, you know, because it was less of a squad game then, and we only used 18 players that season, which was obviously not something that they consciously strode out to achieve.
Yeah.
But the outcome of that season, having only used 18 players, when, you know, squads are sort of 24 players or so now, is quite good as well. And I think it spoke to how well we were able to keep players fit as well, I think, that season, because there weren't really many injuries. I think the most notable injury was probably Kevin Carr before the first day of the season, when broke his arm, didn't he? And Chris Waddle had to broke his arm on the day.
On the day.
Step in.
And Waddle had to go.
And Chris Waddle went in goal for the second half.
And kept a clean sheet.
Still won. Yeah, but I don't think he had an awful lot to do. I think Leeds were a bit of a funny side, thinking back, because I always thought of Leeds as being, you know, I mean, they knocked us out of the League Cup the year before. The road felt difficult to beat, but we did the double over them in 83-84, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure what changed, but maybe they had an aging squad, because I did spot that in my research phase this week. I did spot that Peter Lorimer was still playing for Leeds.
Wow. Okay.
In 83-84, so yeah. I think so. Leeds was one where but that got the season off to a great start as well. But we were able to keep players fit, and crucially keep Keegan fit, and it made all the difference. It made all the difference, I think. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned there Glenn Roeder, perfect timing, because he came in just before Christmas. I mean, Christ, he was QPR's captain in the FA Cup. He was a good. McCreary, I think, he played at one point as well, possibly before.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean. Fine-tuning the squad. John Ryan, who we mentioned, it didn't really work out from up here. He was soon dropped. Kenny Wharton moved to a more comfortable left-back position. This always baffled me, because at one point John Tuitt was what record signing. But did he get put out on loan and then come back, or was he just out of favour? Can you remember?
I can't remember, Mark. I'll be honest. I mean, I think... he was the record signing for a long time, quarter of a million, wasn't it? And he was a good, honest player. I mean, there's the thing, Newcastle could never afford players, you know, the kind of, you look back at the 80s, the star players, like, you know, the likes of sort of Barnes and Rush, and then you had, you know, sort of Brian Robson, and, you know, Charlie Nicholas and whatever. And Newcastle couldn't afford players like that then. It was simple, and how we ended up with some players like that was by accident. Hence, you know, Keegan was probably the exception, but again, we couldn't assign Kevin Keegan without the Brewery's help at the time. The club was potless, and Peter Beardsley and Chris Waddle were really accidents. I think Arthur Cox definitely knew what he was doing, but I don't think he realised. I don't think anybody could have realised how what a legend he was sort of unearthing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find fantastic. I mean, you know, we're going into the new year now, 1984. you know, we're still around the promotion places. If I remember rightly, Grimsby and Carlisle were also sniffing around as well. So it was probably a six-team battle. And we went to Carlisle around about Christmas, and there's a little story I've heard about that one. We get battered 3-1 just after Christmas. In the days where we played 2 games in 2 days. Imagine that now, there'd be hell on, wouldn't there? One of the supporters invaded the pitch. It would have been Martin Thomas. Had a go at Martin Thomas and took a swing for him because we were getting annihilated off Carlisle.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, right. They were promotion candidates, so it was a little bit extreme. Invade the pitch and take a swing at a player.
Well, it was. But stupidity, isn't it?
Oh, well, of course, mate. But yeah, into the new year, we were drawn against Liverpool away in the FA Cup. Now,
oh God, yeah.
The romantics of this straight away were looking at the return of Kevin Keegan, but obviously Terry Mack was going back as well. It was played out live on television. The BBC cameras wanted to be there. Can you remember watching the game on that Friday night at all?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I watched it next door with the lad we lived next door to at the time, a couple of years older than me, and I kind of idolised him. You know, he was a Newcastle fan. He was into his music, and I would look to him for sort of musical influences and things. We'd play football together and Subutio and all sorts of things, you know. And so we watched it. We went down on our bikes to the paper shop, you know, and I think pick up a quart of cola cubes or whatever, and then cycle back and get in position.
Yeah.
And that's what it was like. And it was an exciting night until the game started.
Well, this is it, Dave. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. We were playing Liverpool. I think they ended up winning the European Cup that season. They probably
Well, it's quite... It's all cyclical, isn't it? Because, we are moaning about Newcastle United.
Yeah.
Moaning about them in the 80s and moaning about them now. And we're talking about Liverpool, who won the league and European Cup then as well.
Yeah.
That was the year they won.
Yeah.
They won the.
They can spare us.
And they won the. Did they win the FA Cup as well?
No, that was the
Everton. Was that the Everton Watford?
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I mean, nice. I ended up the reason why I'm fond of this game, again, I wasn't there, I didn't attend, but the reason why I'm fond of it is because when I was sort of brought up into the footballing world and going to games, you would read, as I mentioned before, half mag, half biscuit. You would read the mag. You read them all. And I remember someone doing an article, for the life of us, I can't remember the name of the journalist, but he did an article in the mag, and he picked his top 10 Newcastle support, the best experiences of him, you know, at St. James's or on the road. And, you know, there was a trip down to West Brom in the 1974 Cup run. That was apparently 15,000. But I read it, and I just thought, hang on, you're seeing there that that's recorded on TV. And, you know, it's easy now to try and build your collection and stuff like that. But back then, I put an advert in a Sunday paper and asking if anyone out there in the sports section of it has got a copy of Newcastle versus Liverpool. And left my telephone number in my mum's landline, got a phone call. Hello, it was a Welsh fella for the life. I think it was called Michael. Phone us up. I've got the game. Yeah, I'll do a copy for you on VHS, obviously. I'll do it for £10. I went, all right. How do we get around this? Okay, send us a check. Oh, okay. Mom, can I have a check? So sent this check to an unknown in Wales. And a week or so later, a videotape drops through my door. But he also gave us a sort of a document of all the other games he had recorded off TV over 20-odd years.
Oh, wow.
So I was looking through them and going, oh, man, can I have another £10? He's got Leeds, Newcastle, 1982-83. She looked and she went, well, why do you want that? You get B3-1. I went, oh, but look at the little asterisk next to it. It's got, you had a little footnote saying, hooliganism, bad terrorist antics. I thought, I want to see that, you know? But I never got the money. And to this day, it's never been out there, no one's YouTube or nothing, so it's another one what sort of passed me by. But back to the Liverpool game, watched it back with this hope of it being an unbelievable atmosphere. And Christ, Newcastle support that day was unbelievable. I mean, your age, you probably didn't really look at it from a point of view of an atmosphere. You probably just looking at the players, I suppose.
No, I think I'd a bit of both. I think because we had fantastic seats in this promotion season, by the way. We were sort of front centre, upper tier of the East Stand. at the time, I don't think, unless you were the corresponding seats in the West Stand, which are for directors, I don't think you could have got a better seat. So I could sense, you know, that when there was a big game, you know, particularly though when there's a Leeds, you know, play Middlesbrough or Leeds or, you know, Sheffield or Chelsea, any of those sort of crucial games, and you could sort of sense, you could sense it on the walk up to the ground, actually. It's just the throng and the noise, and, you know, and start to hear the noise coming from inside the ground and things, and, you know, and the memories are very sort of misty eyed and nostalgic for me from back then. But, you know, there's things like, that was, for example, the time when you would hear the phrase in the papers, you know, they had to lock the gates at 2:30 sort of thing, for some of the games, you know, that lockout, you know. But then, you know, there was less less satisfying things like the National Front selling their rag outside the Gallagher end in the early 80s. And I remember that. And I remember my dad dragging me away to give him a wide berth, and me sort of saying, who's that? And he was saying, you don't need to bother about that, you know. And probably, you know, didn't want to sort of, definitely didn't want me to get mixed up with that bloody lot. But, you know, and that was sort of an unsavoury side. Going back to, you know, mentioning what, alluding to what I mentioned earlier about the crowd trouble being a big problem, not just at Newcastle, but in football generally and in society generally, at the time. And it kind of led to, you know, led to those fences going up, which caused problems with the people. The fences did nothing for the atmosphere, I'll say that. But the east side of the ground escaped the fences, of course. So it meant, what I observed that season, it meant a bit of a shift from lunatics being not necessarily confined to the Gallagher end, but we found they were now in the benches.
yeah.
Because they had nothing, there's no fence there. And I tell you what, opposing wingers and fullbacks got hell off them benches, didn't they?
I mean just to elaborate on the benches, because a lot of the younger generation probably don't know where that was, but that was right. The front section of the east stand, shall we say, separated by plush executive boxes, which if I remember right, I think I only went in there once or twice, the benches, but every time something happened, yeah, you would look back into the executive boxes and tell the blokes who had paid a fortune to sit there, out the way, we want to see what's happened on the telly, on the replay, you know?
That's it. And what came with that was the, very, very occasionally, the ball would come over and land on top of the boxes, yeah, and somebody would have to jump down. And I've always gutted that it was never me. I'd never had the bottle to go, right, I'm getting this.
Yeah.
Dad, take a picture of us.
Well, can you remember a guy who used to always managed to jump down and get it, and he used to always spin the ball on his finger like a basketball player, and everyone used to it was like, remember, you know, like from the east stand you had that Davy T lad who used to always do the Indian war cry, you had
so
you're right what you're saying, there was some proper characters went in there, but yeah, as you say, great view. Obviously you've had an upgrade from the West Stand from the previous season, but back to the fixtures. I mean, we got beat 4-0. It was never a surprise in that cup game. We weren't in all this at the time, but Keegan would retire on the back of that game. He went for chasing a long ball with Mark Lawrence. He's even said, you know,
yeah,
Lawrence had a couple of yard head start, and he ended up outpacing him and comfortably taking the ball. And Keegan then ended up announcing his retirement a few weeks later. We'll come to that in a moment, though, because one of the standout games, Dave, Portsmouth away. Caught on the big match highlights. Again, they're up on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, I'll let you elaborate more, but what an outstanding performance.
I wasn't there, we went to about 3 away games, I think, that season. A friend of mine, actually, I remember speaking to a friend of mine, Jimmy King, from college, some years later, and he was there, and he was telling me, he was phenomenal. He was, I mean, the goals, we can see the goals for ourselves on the on the incredible footage that you've got there. But just the, I think from remember from what he was saying, from just judging from how Newcastle played in the years leading up to this season, and then to see a performance like that, he was just he was just blown away. And Beardsley's goal, I think Beardsley's first goal just before half time, was I think goes down as Beardsley's best ever goal for me, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean talk the listeners through it who haven't seen it, mate. I mean, if you can,
it was a ball in. Keegan picked up the ball in the left wing. I remember it. I mean, I'm not even watching it here, but he picked up the ball in the left wing and kind of chipped it into the left side of the box as you approach the goal, and Beardsley scampered into the box, and I think with a race with the defender, I think just took a touch, and the defender slipped past him, missed it, and then he brought the ball under control, and then he kind of feigned to shoot. He was literally 2 yards outside the goal by this point. He feigned to shoot. The keeper slid past him, and he dummied, and then he was left with like 1 yard out on the goal line. And he just tapped it in, and I think the whole of the ground applauded that. It seemed from the footage. I think the home fans realised they'd seen something special there as well. But what was interesting for me about that game was that, this isn't a memory because it's quite specific, but it was something I picked up from the programmes that I hadn't realised was prior to that game that Keegan had been angered by suggestions that he was actually going to join Portsmouth at the end of the season.
You're right.
And I wonder if that spurred him on because he had a belting game. And you know, the Beardsley and Keegan got two each. And I mean, really, coming at early February as well, I can imagine that at the time that probably felt like to people that promotion was looking a reality now.
Well, you mentioned Keegan then, yes, on the post-match interview. There was speculation of him going there. I can't remember exactly why, because obviously it was before my time, but I don't know whether Portsmouth had some sort of investor and they thought they could entice Keegan for one last final payday. Because again, Keegan had signed a one-year contract initially, then he agreed to stay for a second year. So by rights, he wasn't going to be our player from the end of the season. So there was a lot of worry that we're going to lose him. But lo and behold, as I mentioned earlier, he announced his retirement a few days later. And in typical Newcastle fashion, we're back at Portsmouth away 4-1, then we'll lose it at home to Grimsby 1-0.
it sort of echoes the 11 out of 11 season in 92-93, doesn't it, where Grimsby ended that as well. So I mean, these things happen. It happened at the end of the season as well, you know, with the Cambridge slip up, and we mentioned it at the start of the season, it was win-lose the first four games. It was very topsy-turvy. These things happen, what Arthur Cox, I think, and the lads did a good job of doing was not let these little slip-ups linger. They never turned into sort of four or five game bad runs, like they might have done, and that's to their credit. You know, they held it together, and I think it was almost like that season we had two managers. You know, had Cox and Keegan. In fact, almost you could almost argue three, because Terry Mack. I wouldn't like to underplay the amount of influence that Terry Mack had on things. Not just at the club, but the local nightclubs as well.
Yeah,
I've heard he was fond of. That's one of the things that used to flash up on the scoreboard. Is Tuxedo Junction.
Right.
He fell down at Tuxedo Junction, which was a nightclub in town at the time.
Right.
And I've heard that Terry Mack was a season ticket holder, shall we say.
well, I read his book on holiday last year. It's remarkable the career he actually had and the success he had as a footballer, considering how much he put away in the bars. You know, it's absolutely phenomenal how he kept himself, you know, at such a high level. Still at this point as well, you know, still put great performances in. But we're into the running, as you say, February. Games coming
thick and fast. Yeah, the business end.
The business end, yeah, thick and fast. We got beat off Grimsby, but we went to Man City and turned them over 2-1. I mean, 41,000 there for a second division game. That's pretty impressive. Well,
And I mean, going back to attendances, that'd be one that Man City fans will sort of point out and go, ah, well, you know, like I say, it was all relative. Football wasn't as popular. You know, there was lots of things that would keep people away. And the size of grounds would vary as well. And I think Man City had a bigger ground than everybody else in the division around that time. So with the exception, possibly, I think Hillsborough was probably 40 plus.
Yeah.
Hillsborough is always a nice ground as well. Still is.
Yeah.
Still is, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, a phenomenal, and in typical style, another phenomenal goal by Beardsley made the difference.
Yeah. I mean, it started there, and you could say that was probably the perfect time to really, really turn results into wins, because I'm not going to give too much away at this moment, but went on a great, fantastic run of form, particularly at home. But you touched on away games, Dave. Had you been to an away game at this point?
I had. I mean, really, as I say, my first sort of football game probably was at Feetham's, probably to see Darlington, because that's where we lived. But the season before, we went down to Middlesbrough for the game down there, and a lot of bother down there.
I do remember reading that.
On that day. I can't remember where we were. I suspect we were probably, this was something that my dad did at the time, which was quite canny of him when you think back. But he would often buy tickets in the home end, in the seats. Just playing percentages of that's probably likely to be the safest part of the ground, amongst the home regulars. And as long as we keep our voices down, we'll be all right.
Yeah.
So that was the trade-off, is if we scored, can you control yourself? But we might have been in the home crowd, and having not long, you know, come north from Darlington, we probably had sort of the right accent
for
the home end of Middlesbrough. So definitely. And it was a, I think it was a 1-1 draw. I think it was a bit sort of something and nothing. In terms of the influence on the season, but we went to that, but this season, by this point, we hadn't been to any, and in fact, we went to three aways, and they were all really they were all in this run-in, this magical run-in, March through to May, which I think, as you were going to touch on there, started with that Man City away game, and which kicked off another 9-match unbeaten run. And really, as we got into March, cemented that third place. We just had to keep avoiding defeat, really, keep winning. I would always say, you know, keep winning the home games and draw your away games and you'll be all right. And that's pretty much, you know, it's pretty much what we did. And the first away game that we did that season, which was actually Shrewsbury away. But why exactly? Exactly. Well, it came the week after we beat Middlesbrough 3-1, which for me personally was a huge result, because I was starting to get an understanding of the local rivalry aspect, and obviously without Sunderland being there, Sunderland we wouldn't happen upon Sunderland until the next season when we got promoted. The Middlesbrough seemed to be the best thing that we had in terms of local derby, and you could sense it on the day as well. You could sense sort of the atmosphere. It was sort of crackly, you know, with the away fans being kept well away from everybody else, you know, and the sort of singing and pointing would happen, and it kind of led to, you know, it all contributed to very very exciting build up of the game. I didn't know any Middlesbrough fans at school. In fact, I didn't know any Newcastle fans at school. And that's something that back then, all my pals at school would support, you know, Man United and Liverpool. Or there was a guy who was, one of my best friends actually was a Blackburn fan, but that's because that's where his family were from. But, you know, so I was pretty much the only Newcastle fan that I was aware of at the middle school in Whitley Bay. Can you believe that? You know, you contrast that to now, and you know, it's everybody. But it wasn't fashionable then, and people would laugh at us. They'd say, "Oh, Newcastle get beat, eh?" Like, yeah. And I remember people laughing at us years later when we sold Peter Beardsley as well. And I thought, "Aye, well, you know, yeah, support your local team. You know, bugger off, leave me alone."
Yeah.
You know, you get all defensive like that. But
well,
go on.
I was just going to say, you know, Shrewsbury, I mean, you would have been, what, 10-ish at the time, I suppose, 11?
We were, and I did, and you sort of say, why that game, and why indeed, I think, I did speak to my dad about it this week, and he said, I think like most away games, I think we decided to go on a whim, usually on a Friday night, and my dad had ring my uncle, like, fancy going down, all right then, and I think my uncle either lived sort of in the East Midlands or Durham, around that time, so we would sort of pick him up on the way. But Shrewsbury, I don't know why we went. It was so far away. I mean, it's almost in bloody Wales, and it just seemed to be such a long journey. And I think it was one of those where we set off in plenty of time, but there was roadworks, there was this, that, and the other, and we got there. We got in the ground, I think, at 5 to 3, and. But what was an eye-opener for me for away games was that we were that bit closer to the action. Because if we weren't in the home seats, I think as with Shrewsbury, we were just paid on the door and just stood behind the goal with the rest of the Newcastle fans. It was all fine. But we were that bit closer. You could kind of see, you know, I could see Beardsley and Keegan breathing, you know, and talking to each other, and it was like, wow, mm-hmm. You had to talk to each other during the game. I didn't know.
Well, when you mentioned that, there was only 8,000 there that day. I mean, I'm saying only that was probably Shrewsbury's biggest crowd of the season. Now,
I think that'll have been, I think that'll have been a bit like the Cambridge result being their big result of the season. I think Shrewsbury probably enjoyed the visit to Keegan was a draw. I think at most away games.
Well, you mentioned the 9-game unbeaten run. It was continuing, albeit we drew 2-2 that day. We beat Leeds 1-0. I think Dennis Irwin, who you mentioned before, he scored the own goal that day. So you must have the manager must have listened to Arthur Cox and started playing him, you know. And then Swansea beat them 2-0 at home. And Charlton away, I believe it was 1-0 each until a few minutes to go, and we ended up scoring two very, very late goals and winning it 3-1. In another game
I think that was not when Keegan had announced his retirement, and I think he got presented with something.
That's right.
The game, didn't he?
It was officially his last appearance in London.
Cool, that's tenuous, isn't it?
Well, it,
I suppose the nearest to what happens now that nowadays is kind of the accusation thrown at them of how can we make this about us.
But a fantastic win, as I say, 3-1 at Charlton, and then Sheffield Wednesday, promotion rivals, the company seniors bring up thousands. It was very rare. You tell me more so at the time, but it's very rare that the away support would pack out the Leeds end.
There was only one or two. I seem to recall Leeds, but Leeds was a rearrangement of the game that was frozen out in January, I believe, because there was two programmes that year for the Leeds game as well. And I think there wasn't many. I think Leeds might have been one, but certainly Sheffield Wednesday and Chelsea were amongst the sides who, I mentioned earlier about the sort of the odd segregation configurations that they would make in the Leeds end around that time, because they had the centre section and the two corners separated by two small kind of no man's land areas that were fenced off. But sometimes, sometimes that clubs would, your new clubs would bring enough to fill the whole end. So the whole, it was just, I mean, obviously for Sunderland was another one that would fill the whole end the following season and subsequently. But it was, and again, going back to atmosphere, that, you know, it all led to sort of building up of a, you know, a really exciting atmosphere. at a really exciting part of an exciting season. You know, I mean, it was just real halcyon days.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we went down 1-0 that day. I think it was Gary Shelton who scored a brilliant overhead kick.
Gary Shelton, cracking goal.
Yeah, and
I've never, not for a long time afterwards, had I been as impressed with how wild that away end went when that goal went in.
Yeah.
God, I tell you, arms and legs. Yeah.
When you saw the first, one of the first things you did do, I was the same. You would look at it in an away end on any game and look and go, oh, wow, their supporters look mint celebrating that goal. But ultimately, they're just doing what are they for, aren't they? You know, but... I was just going to say we'll get beat 1-0. You know, we're still destiny was probably still in our own hands with six or so to go. I mean, you've got the fixture list there. You run through your memories with me because you went. Was there any more away games, obviously, out of that, the bunch that you went to?
Yeah. Looking back, we went to Blackburn away. And you know, it's probably just because it was one of the closer ones. And that was, we again in that sort of nine match unbeaten run, towards the end of the season, it was kind of every point counted. We just lost it, at home to Chef Wed. So, you know, Sheffield Wednesday were a bit of a, bit of a sort of bogey side. I would always term Sheffield Wednesday and Chelsea around that time as our nemesis, because we would always have bother against them, you know, on the pitch, you know, probably off as well. But on the pitch, there would always be tough games, and there would always be, games that we would take very seriously at the time. But yeah, Blackburn, and then obviously you can't mention that season without mentioning Huddersfield away, Mark.
Well, I mean, that's another one I've mentioned before, you know, if footage. I mean, if someone's got any footage out there, I'd love to see it, but I've only seen pictures of if what happened. I'll let you describe it in more action, in more detail. But, you know, Blackburn away, I would imagine that would have been Good Friday, because look at the dates of the fixtures. Carlisle was a bank holiday. Was it that Easter Monday? Or have I just totally got that wrong?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't got the days of the week.
Yeah,
but it sounds about right, actually. Yeah, yeah. Sounds about right. That
Carlisle is a
that.
We mentioned support as there in regards to goal celebrations. But one of the best memories of that season for me, obviously on video, is when Kevin Carr saves a penalty, and we go straight up the other end and score. But I don't know whether you ever noticed that guy on the crash barrier in the scoreboard, and he's serenading. He's facing away from the pitch. And he's serenading the supporters.
Yeah.
And obviously we score, and all of a sudden you just see his body go. You know, he's been the choir instructor, he's getting the fans singing, and then all of a sudden we score, and pretty much game over, and this body just goes missing in the crowd. So fantastic.
That's brilliant, isn't it? What a story to tell your kids.
Oh, well, yeah. Disappointing in reality, because I think they hadn't won for about 20 odd games, and they ended up going down, I believe, that season.
Well, I mean,
4-0.
That derby game, I mean, from footage, I mean, we were in the East Stand, but Beardsley was just ran riot, and he didn't stop. And actually, what was interesting was that. I think after the fourth goal, you can see it on the footage that you have, Mark. Arthur Cox walks back towards the bench as if to sit down. But just before he does, he looks over at the Derby bench and sort of shouts, 4-0.
Really?
Like
I've never
that.
Noticed that.
I'm sure he does. I haven't checked back. But, ultimately, it seems that Cox was unwittingly delivering his job interview on that day. Unfortunately for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we were as good as up at that point. It wasn't mathematically guaranteed, but we were as good as up.
No, that's right. We were a point away, and then Derby had some decent players in the side. And, you know, it seemed to be an era for catching the back end of some, you know, amazing players' careers.
Was Gemmell playing for them then? Archie Gemmell? Was he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Kenny Burns,
yes,
the twice European Cup winner, was clearly, He was clearly put on the pitch to Mark Waddle, and he couldn't get near him all day. So,
That's good to
but
hear.
I remember having a headache after that game, and I think it was all too much. It was the just the occasion, the excitement, the hot weather, and in the East Stand we'd have the blazing sun in our faces for 2 hours. And then Beardsley, watching Beardsley's diving header, I thought with a headache, I thought, how bad, I bet that knacked.
Oh, without a doubt.
But I mean, yeah, we and that I think there was and after that game there was definitely a desire for the fans to start the celebrations, and I think there was a reluctance from Arthur Cox and the players. I think they were or did they do a
Did?
did they do like a go around the pitch? I can't remember because I thought that was only Brighton.
What did correct? Even though we weren't mathematically promoted and we still had two fixtures to go,
They thought, what the hell?
they thought, yeah, I would understand them if it was the last
They
quarter.
wouldn't do that now, would they?
Oh, without a doubt. The supporters would have told them to piss off, let's be honest. Now they would have, oh, hang on a second, get back to reality. But because it was such a comfortable victory, probably got lost in the occasion because they went out there, and as I say, I would have understood it if that was the last home game of the season, but it wasn't. We had Huddersfield to come.
Golly.
Again, that was the main holiday. Huddersfield away.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I think the games you mentioned before were across the Easter weekend, and I think the Derby was May Day, wasn't it?
So Huddersfield then. And I've heard so many stories about it. There's
Huddersfield.
25,000 there, and depending on who you talk to or what you read, there's anything from 10 to 20,000 Newcastle there. I'd love to have seen the footage. Yet to find it. Know little about the game. Over to you, Dave.
Well, remember little about the game. More remember more about the occasion. But I remember again, it will have been one of these, on a whim, or how it lets go down, nothing planned. Because back then, of course, you can just pay on the door. And how crazy is that for a promotion clincher? And they will have known how many people wanted to go down, and it was pay on the door. Incredible, because I was just checking back a few weeks ago and found that I was disappointed to find that I didn't have a ticket stub from that game, and so yeah, because we didn't buy tickets for many games back then, but yeah, 12,000 I think is the accepted sort of figure of how many people travelled down to Leeds Road, and it seemed that there was just Newcastle fans on all four sides of the ground. But it was yeah, it was exciting. You could sense. I mean, we all knew what the occasion was, and we just had to get a point. But you could sort of feel it as well. It was tangible. It was in everybody's faces, and the singing and just the excitement. And the silver strips. I mean, the one of the things that stood out for me that season was that that we had new strips and a new badge, in fact. And and from the first game onward, the lads looked magnificent. And not only, and this is not very often, not only did they look magnificent at home, when they wore the silver away strip, they looked even more fantastic. They look like spacemen.
People are fond of that era. I mean, listeners won't see this, but obviously, I know you've got that the home kit on that of well, a shirt of that season. It's such a retro shirt, but as you say, of such fond memories of that of them
That's it.
kits, you know.
Well, the shirt's painted on. Unfortunately, I did have, as you've seen the picture, I did have the that was my silver away top as well, but that's been lost over the years, unfortunately. But what can you do? But yeah, I remember it being excited about the game, but being a bit kind of like, oh, now then, Keegan's not playing, so what does that mean? And it was a bit of a new thing for me. I know, he missed a few games the season before, but it still felt like a bit of a, well, what happens now? And I think, and then we went 2-0 down, and I think, that was kind of a, here we go, yeah, we're nothing without Keegan. We're a one-man team, and people were sort of worrying. I liken it to whenever Keegan didn't play, it felt like the stabilizer had been taken off the bike. And Beardsley wore number 7, and David Mills, who I mentioned at the top of the program, was in the in the side and played a key role. But what one thing that stood out, I start to sort of think back, and when we were stood at the front of the home end, but I was more or less at eye line level with the pitch, so I can't have had a great view of anything. But that's just kind of that typical thing of, you know, shove the kids down the front. And I stood down there, and I remember getting cinder off the track blown in my eyes and things. But one of the most bizarre things was that I looked to one side and realised the guy stood next to me was the guy I sit next to in the East Stand at St James's. So it's like, how bizarre is that, you know? And I remember the just looking behind and just seeing like an almost endless sea of black and white. You know, it was sort of my 74 semi-final moment looking back at the away end. It wasn't the cop at Hillsborough, but it was the you know, the sort of this away end at Huddersfield, and then, you know, and shouting, chanting, singing the cowshed at the fans in the opposite end. It was quite a popular word for the grounds that had those big cavernous barns behind the goal, you know, that in the old style grounds that's what we're singing. And one of the overriding memories, I can't remember if it was at half time or during the game, but I looked behind me, I'd hear a commotion, and I just saw this. And he'll been pissed up, but this Newcastle fan in a black and white kilt just come tumbling head over heels all the way down the steps, kind of landed at the bottom just behind me, and he was fine. He got up and dusted himself down, but I just thought, yeah, this is the sort of day it is, you know. But then 2-0 down after 25 minutes, it's like back to, you know, it's kind of reality, and you kind of think, well, oh God, is this going to be a similar misstep to Cambridge? You know, is this going to put pressure on the Brighton game? We want the Brighton game to be a party, not a big stressful panic, you know. But we needn't worry, because I think we were level 2-2 by half time. So, and it was Beardsley and my man David Mills,
yeah,
who got the goals there. So
can you remember much about? Obviously, the pictures I've seen, the players are doing another sort of, I wouldn't say lap of honour. I would imagine the fans invaded the pitch and give them, you know, cheered them around the pitch to celebrate. But can you remember, did you stick around then, or was it a case of just get yourselves out on the way home? Or
I can't remember. No. We did have a tendency to get ourselves away.
Yeah.
And it might have been something my dad anticipated about it being a big surge to the front.
Right.
And you know, and different priorities, you know. I'm looking back thinking, oh, Dad, why didn't you throw me over the fence, you know?
Yeah.
And he'll have been thinking how I feel about my daughters now is no.
Yeah.
No chance. Without you're lucky that we've even been going.
Well,
you know.
Well, this is it. A little anecdote linking to that is actually, it's probably, if I'm not mistaken, that was a Tuesday night, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it was my birthday, but
yeah,
it was a midweek night, definitely. Yeah.
Well, similar story. I went down with lads. You will remember who I was at the time when you drove us to away games and whatnot. The lads I was with, my brother Wayne, we lost them in the crush behind the goal, and at the end, all
right.
I wanted to do was invade the pitch, but ultimately, I couldn't. I thought, well, hang on, I need to find my little brother, you know. So
I was the same. I lost the people I was with as well, so I didn't go over. But a couple of lads, some of the lads listening might remember the name Decker. It's one of the lads who went to games home and away,
right,
back in the day, and you know, he liked to gargle, and he was over the fence on the final whistle, and I think he stopped and I think he was sick at the feet of the Grimsby goalkeeper, the Grimsby goalkeeper said something less than sympathetic back to him, but I don't think anybody was really really that bothered. But yeah, I lost the people I was with, so I kind of stayed put like a good lad, and just enjoyed it from behind the goal. But yeah, great night.
And then Brighton, it's all set up. Keegan's final game, promotion already.
Well, it
back.
Was, and it was just, you know, just unfortunate for. So I keep mentioning David Mills. I actually was compelled. I felt compelled enough to buy his book, which which he wrote, which I've got here, There But for Fortune, it's called. And it's got a nice chapter, which I've read about about this 83-84 season and about how he fit into things and circumstances upon which he returned, and then how he kind of moved on. He ultimately moved on back to Middlesbrough, didn't he? But he must have been the most unlucky striker to join Newcastle, to join and expect to have to compete with Keegan Beardsley and Waddle front line.
Yeah. Because what wasn't?
But whenever he did get a game, he was always 100%. He was all over the pitch, and I really liked him as a player. And he was unlucky to lose his place for that Brighton game. But Beardsley coming back. Keegan coming back, he could not, obviously he couldn't, Cox couldn't have done anything different. But from what I read in the book, Mills took it on the chin and understood. And testament to the man. And I think a lot of what you don't tend to find a lot as much of now is back then, I think you had players who were gentlemen. I know it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but you had principled footballers. Like David Mills, who was honest, and he was like, yeah, I know my place in this squad. I'm not going to start kicking off because I'm not getting a place ahead of Peter Beardsley. Keegan was another one, that rather than try and stretch out his career or drop into midfield, maybe slow it down. It's not his style. And he's remembered much better as a consequence for the way that he did do it, with Alvida saying Kev and the helicopter, and all of that. But yeah, we come to the final game of the season at home to Brighton, and again, just the first thing I think of when I think of that game is just boiling hot sunshine.
Yeah.
We'd done what we had to do. The promotion was assured, and it was a day to enjoy. That's all. There was no stress. There was no bother about the results. There was no, we need to keep him fit. It was just a pure day of enjoyment, and that's what we got. And it was unforgettable.
Well, I mean, we bowed out and sailed, didn't we? All them 3 metres, yep. As you mentioned, all scored 3-1. Beardsley, yep. that goal when he a bad ball from Keegan. Let's be honest, he ended up tackling 10.5 on the ball back. Absolutely.
Well, that sort of slide tackle scoop,
yes,
of the ball, and then to just instantly turn, mm-hmm. and chip, former England goalkeeper, 6'5",
yeah,
was just like, yeah, how dare you do that, Peter?
Yeah.
It was like, that's kind of what you think of. But I think even Joe Corrigan had a sense of humour about him enough to go, yeah, that, some good goals there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and he was at the tail end of his career as well, Joe Corrigan.
Yeah.
So I think he kind of the pressure was off him.
Well, style promotions assured. Keegan was to get his farewell game now, but I don't know if you know this, but the following day we actually played Darlington away.
I didn't, but I do now.
Yeah.
I noticed that from looking. Well, say from just having a glance through some of my old stuff,
mm-hmm.
To remind myself. Yeah, and I was thinking, well, God, why didn't we go to that? And it was probably because we probably didn't know about it.
Right.
Because games, if friendlies and things popped up, because it was a benefit game for David Barton,
yeah.
I think, wasn't it,
former right.
player, and. Yeah, not unlike now with social media, websites, and the reach that a message from, if they choose to deliver one, a message from the club has a global reach, an instant global reach. Back then, if you didn't pick up a certain paper, or chat with one of your mates who found out in the pub, you just didn't know about it, So that's probably the reason. And it wasn't in the programme. It wasn't even the Brighton programme. It wasn't listed as the next fixture. Presumably because it wasn't part of the league or cup season. So.
So okay. Well, you missed that one, unfortunately, even though it was on your doorstep. But
well, not then. I mean, we were in Whitley Bay then.
Of course.
It could have been a nice It could have been a nice trip back to see Nana and Grandad. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, have a word with your dad about that and have a go at him.
I will. Yeah. So, fortunate. Yeah. Again, consider myself fortunate to have been there. We were in the East Stand. I'm not ashamed to say there was tears that night from little me, and they were tears of definitely tears of happiness at just the occasion. But it was, I think there was tears of, oh bloody hell, what do we do now, as well, because I think it was clear from, I was clear from the season and the Huddersfield game that Peter Beardsley would be the man to kind of lead the line, you know, in Keegan's absence going forward. But it was like, well, I know, but what we're going to do without him? And it was, yeah. And I think it all kind of culminated in kind of that feeling of like, you know, it's like, don't go. it was really a bittersweet night. But I think we one of the big big aspects of excitement for that night was that we were welcoming, you know, the champions of everything, Liverpool. And I don't think St James's Park, I hadn't seen them play before. St James's hadn't seen Liverpool since 76, I don't think. And sort of welcome them back, you know, Grobbelaar and Craig Johnson and Ian Rush and everyone. It was, yeah, it was exciting. It was an exciting night. And then obviously the, you know, the rounded off with the spectacle of the helicopter exit.
To the one of the stewards and said, "Give that to Peter Beardsley." And Peter Beardsley said, "To this day, he doesn't know where that shirt is."
Didn't get it. No.
So a steward pulled the fast one there. But so, you're right, mate. I mean, I was getting goosebumps when I'm hearing the passion in your voice about that night, because there's games in your life and you look back and go, oh, I wish I was there. You know, I wish I was at the Burnley semi-final.
Yeah.
I wish I was, you know, there's that Liverpool game we mentioned to you before, just for the support. But that Keegan farewell, you know, it sounds to me as if it was the end of a probably a surreal chapter, if I'm right in saying. And I suppose...
It was definitely that, yeah.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is, you know, you mentioned David Mills, you mentioned obviously the retirement of Kevin Keegan, you mentioned Arthur Cox, John Tuick, who had come back into the side. All four of those, and obviously Terry McDermott as well, five people, massively important players in promotion. And the following season, all five of them were gone. Or, in the case of Terry McDermott, because of a contract dispute, he was banished to the juniors, he never played for the club again.
I just always assumed Terry Mack retired, but Truick was John Truick was a funny one for me, because he actually lived in our estate in Whitley Bay.
All right,
in a little three bed detached in where we lived at the time, and we got wind of this. Word got round the school. I went round one time to get his autograph, and he's just a lovely guy, just like. You know, you're probably getting sick of kids knocking on the door, but, you know, every time, you know, to me, you'd open the door, big smile, hey, how are you doing? You know, and I'd say, oh, can I have your autograph, please? You know, and he's like, yeah, no problem, you know. And I think, you know, players like it gave you sort of a good reassuring feeling that there was players like that around, you know, good sort of honest professionals. Keegan was always. I remember in some book, Keegan sort of saying, one tip I'd always give professional footballers is always carry a marker pen, because you never know when you're going to get stopped to ask for an autograph. Well, and I thought that's typical of Keegan. That.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
to think of situations where he probably had a back pocket full of those little cards with his picture on, you know, that he would just sign for people. You know,
without a doubt. And let's be honest.
He was a true pro.
Well. You mentioned Keegan there, VIP section, and we just thought, we'll just go to the show. I'm not bothered about VIP. Plus the cost, it was ridiculous, but it was for charity. So ultimately, you go, okay, well, you know, they've got to make the money. But we were sort of hovering around the VIP area outside, and me and the lads. There was a good squad of us that night. You know, going back years and years of following Newcastle, people have dropped out that don't go like yourself for Ashley reasons or whatever. But we were hovering around the VIP area, and one of the lads just said, Kev, is there any chance for a quick photo? And he went, aye, but just you're going to have to be quick, lads. I don't want to get sprung. And, you know, and I just think, that's great, that. He was risking.
Don't tell Steve.
Yeah. I'm going to risk getting bollocks off the organisers because you scruffs haven't paid an extra 50 quid to come and stand with me. But yeah, we got a photo, and you know, straight away it was up on Facebook. I'm sure it's on my Twitter account. But yeah. I don't get starstruck, but just standing next to the man, I was just, wow, it's Kevin Keegan.
It's hard not to, isn't it? I know, it's hard not to. I mean, I used to play a bit of football. Well, we used to play with some school friends. We put together a five-a-side team and played in the midweek leagues at Wallsend Boys Club. And at the end of one season, I think we finished third or fourth, and we had these little trophies that you get, you know. And we each got one. And one year they were presented by Beardsley, and another year they were presented by Paul Gascoigne, who was just coming through, sort of mid-80s. And yeah, it was very difficult not to feel starstruck on those occasions. But I remember a time it'll have been the close season, just after we escaped, and I mean that in every sense, from Leicester away. At the end of that season, we nearly went into Division 3. And we were doing our usual. And this is me and Ruben, the guy who used to do half mag, half biscuit with. And we're doing our usual thing, go up the ground, see how they're getting on with the leaders' end. You know, we'd pop into the club shop, have a bit of a mooch around, I would take some photos. And lo and behold, Kevin Keegan walks over. And bear in mind, at the time, Ruben had one of his feet in a pot. And so Keegan was like, well, I'm there then. And he says, oh, well, I was. And it was the most ridiculous thing that he broke his foot dancing to one of Kelly's goals on the video in his house.
Right.
Which, let's face it, we've all done, right? But he got unlucky and broke his foot. So anyway, so he told Keegan this. He said, oh, David Kelly scored. And I went mad, and I stepped on the fireplace. And Keegan sort of says, aye, David Kelly's got a lot to answer for, and walked off. And I thought, that's interesting. And I thought, you know, God, what an invitation to read between the lines.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, I don't think we've ever got the bottom of why David Kelly left, have we?
Well, Kelly, a year or so ago, I spoke to him at another talking, you know, just had a bit cracking up with him. And he basically just made it clear that he wanted first team football. West Ham, he got dropped, so he got sold to Leicester. At Leicester, he got dropped, got sold to Newcastle. And obviously at Newcastle, Keegan turned around and said, look, I can't guarantee you a start, but I want you to stick around. And Kelly he said, I wanted first team football. He went and he said, oh, you're bringing in Peter Beardsley, Andy Coe's, you know, the hot prospect, I've got no chance. He went, his words were, pay us up and I'll go. So obviously, he probably got a few hundred quid and left the Wolves.
But I actually met him that following season. I think it was the Coventry away game.
Yes.
We were back in the Premier League. And I was selling the fanzines outside the away end, and he walked past and had a chat with him. And I've got a photograph, but it's a bit... I'll try and scan it and send you it, Mark. But it's a bit dark because it was a night match, so it was a bit dusky. And even though it was August, it was a bit of a dusky evening, so not a very good quality photo. But he's a lovely guy. But I think with a lot of the players, I mentioned about Arthur Cox leaving as well. That was another thing that kind of passed me by at the time, and until the next season, then everyone was talking about Jack Charlton. But I must have kind of switched off from it. But I just, you know, typical Newcastle, not wanting to just stretch out a little bit. I think as Keegan said at the time, now is the time for the club to get into debt, to build on what we've done, and they didn't want to. And you know, wouldn't it just be Newcastle United if we didn't kill the goose that laid the golden egg? Eh? That's my analogy for the Cox situation.
The memories and the positivity from Keegan, that Keegan 2-year spell, I think it's quite rare that we do these podcasts where the majority of that period was positive. On that note, Dave, I think what we could do is always revisit the top flight divisions from Jack Charlton onwards, mate. So I'm more than happy to do more in the future with you, mate, because I've really, really enjoyed it. I mean, as I said before, the passion, your voice and the memories coming back, learning little snippets of information along the way. It's been fascinating for me, mate. So I can't thank you enough for that.
It's been a pleasure.
You mentioned the Leicester game before. I will mention this to the listeners. Dave, you used to carry a camera around a hell of a lot back in the days when people didn't, let's be honest. But you've captured some unbelievable moments. You know, for the listeners, there was a load of pictures from the away end at Leicester that day, which is basically getting used everywhere now. You know, with the fans on the pitch, there's a couple of great pictures you've got. And one of my favourites, which you shared again with me in the last week or so, was that that one from Boot Boy Alley, or Def Alley, down the East End, of the Petrol's dear but cheap to burn hammers. What an absolutely fantastic bit of graffiti.
Well, I mean that's almost prose, isn't it? It's almost it's worthy of Keats almost, I think, isn't it? I think it challenged only by the other bit of graffiti nearby, which I remember, which just said Seymour is shit. So, I think the petrol one was a bit more eloquent, although the reason behind it obviously is a little bit more sinister and refers to the petrol bomb incident a couple of years before. But again, that was another instance where I was trying to think back to why I was even up at the ground and took a picture of it. And I think it was another of these situations, you know, in the summer, nothing to do. You know, we got together, a few beers, have a wander around the ground, see if they're doing any work on anything. And I think I kind of thought, I'll take a picture of this just, you know, before somebody wipes it off, you know. And it'd been there for a couple of years, but when did I take the picture? I probably took the picture sometime in the 90s, so it'd been there over 10 years.
Oh, I remember it because you put it in print in the HME.
We did, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I think scanned it and popped it up on my Facebook page, and I didn't know that you were on it, and you went, "Oh, that's the picture I took." And you actually said, "Any chance you can edit it? It's cropped me your dress out because you had the mailbox address." That was a little. I went, "Oh, hello, Dave. How are you doing? How's life?" And in the end, you went, "Mark, I'll send you a proper picture if you want, you know." And that's ended up doing the rounds. So, but great, Dave. Look mate, we could talk all day. It's been absolutely fantastic, and I'm no doubt. I know for a fact we'll be doing another one again. We will catch up shortly. I'll put it back to you because there's a lot of people want to pick. Certain seasons. There's a lot in the 80s we haven't covered, from this period, for a couple of seasons. And then, of course, you've got the Keegan effect again, which I know you were heavily involved with home and away, and obviously with the fanzine. So for now, David, I honestly can't appreciate your time. It's been nearly a full match, extra time and a penalty shootout, mate. We're having half talk, but all good stuff. So, Dave,
you've... Just without the drink breaks.
Yeah. Great stuff, David, and as I say, it's been
brilliant
to catch up, and you take care.
You too, absolute pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
No problem. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers.